I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we will take on one of this country's long-running hot-button issues, affirmative action. The Supreme Court announced earlier this week that it would consider a new case on affirmative action. The case is Fisher versus the University of Texas. Abigail Fisher charges that she was denied admission to the university's flagship campus at Austin because of the school's race-conscious admissions policy. You may remember that the High Court last took up this issue in 2003 in a case involving the University of Michigan Law School. But the makeup of the court is very different, and perhaps the country is too. So we wanted to get perspective first from two prominent legal minds and educators. Kevin Johnson is Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. Also with us, Jim Chen. He is Dean and Professor of Law at the Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. He's also a former clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Gentlemen, I thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Dean Johnson, I'm going to start with you and ask, what's the central issue that the court will be considering in this case?
Well, I think the central issue ultimately will be whether the Supreme Court's decision in Grutter versus the University of Michigan, which allows race to be one factor considered in the admissions process, is still good law. I think that the University of Texas in this case had a multifactored, very detailed, very careful admissions process where race was one factor for some part of the admitted class at the University of Texas. And the question is ultimately whether that's constitutional or not.
Dean Chen, can I ask what would cause the court to take up this question at this time? Has something changed since 2003, that other than the makeup of the court that would cause them to reconsider this issue?
Well, the court does from time to time reconsider things on a very short time frame. But I would say that the original decision, when Justice O'Connor wrote, she says this is good for about one generation. And it may well be that 8 years or 9 years would be, for these purposes, on an issue moving this quickly in a society, might be a little bit of an acceleration of that 25-year clock.
Dean Chen, I think that the scuttlebutt around this issue is, for people who perhaps are not that closely connected to the court but who watch this issue closely, is that the court has actually been looking for an opportunity, let's say, to overturn the prior decision because the court is considered to be more conservative than it was in 2003. Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, was replaced by Samuel Alito, who has made it very clear that he's a skeptic of affirmative action. So do you think that that's a fair assessment?
Well, I'd like to speak a little bit about how the court is made up and how the court selects cases, because that might help shed some light on why this case has come up before
please,
the court.
Please
at
do.
This
and
time.
Your experience as a former clerk would certainly be helpful in that.
Sure.
So thank you for that.
So the Supreme Court is, of course, 9 justices. And the interesting thing about that number 9 is that it doesn't take a majority to agree to hear a case. All it takes is 4 votes. And right now, if you look at the composition of the court, what you have is at least 4 votes, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito, as being interested in having another shot at the issue in Grutter. And now the question is whether they firmly believe that Justice Kennedy, whom I think we can predict to be the likely swing vote on this particular issue, would go to the side affirming Grutter. And if they don't believe that that is a certainty and they're willing to revisit the issue, I don't think that, politically speaking, the side that might want a shot at reconsidering Grutter feels it has anything to lose by picking this case and putting it back on the docket.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the affirmative action case recently added to the Supreme Court's docket. My guests are Jim Chen. He is Dean and Professor of Law at the Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville. He's a former clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas, and that's who is speaking just now. Also with us, Kevin Johnson, Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. Dean Johnson, what about you? What's your assessment of this? The same question I asked Dean Chen is that I think the working assumption, particularly among, I think, people who support affirmative action, is that the court has been looking for an opportunity to revisit this issue so that they can overturn affirmative action. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Well, it's always hard to guess what the court is thinking. But in this instance, we do know that it is somewhat of an odd case for the court to take. You know, the plaintiff in the case, Abigail Fisher, is now a graduate. She graduated from LSU And now her claim basically that she was denied access to the University of Texas is more or less moot. And in fact, the University of Texas said that if all you want is your application fee back, we'll give you your fee back since you're no longer, you know, there's no chance that you could be admitted to the University of Texas undergraduate college. So it seems to me that there does seem to be a bit of reaching here. Some people are very surprised that this case was taken up by the court. I think that Dean Chen is exactly right, that we can probably count four justices in favor of overruling Grutter. I do think it's very unclear where Justice Kennedy comes out in the end. He did dissent in the Grutter decision, but at the same time, in the most recent decision considering race in school district admissions policy, he did leave some room in his concurrence for considering race by government at some level. So it's not clear to me the ultimate outcome of the case, but it does set the stage for the possible revisiting of Grutter and a possible overruling of Grutter.
Just want to clarify one thing. I think that Abigail Fisher may be a graduating senior at LSU. I'm not quite sure that she's graduated yet, but I think she's a graduating senior this year. But that being said, if we could just, in the couple of minutes that we have left, the University of Texas policy includes consideration of race as part of a holistic evaluation of applicants who didn't qualify for admission through either superior academic performance or a plan that grants admission to the top 10% of graduates from each Texas high school. It's kind of a unique policy, but I did want to ask each of you, just on the broader issue, if you were arguing this case, what would be your argument on each side? And if you don't mind, Dean Chen, I'll start with you. There are all kinds of arguments that people make. They feel that it demeans and diminishes achievement and all kinds of things. And I know that those aren't your that's not your argument.
Let's start with one thing here.
Sure.
I think what Dean Johnson and I and virtually everyone in higher education, especially in legal education, believes is this. We can't have a legitimate society. We can't have a legitimate legal profession unless it is perceived to be and is representative of all people in our society. So let me focus on the Texas plan here. Four-fifths of the University of Texas's entering class would be admitted on the strength of high school performance. It's an automatic. If you're in the top 10%, you're in. Now, that's in the language of constitutional law. That's something that's facially neutral. There's no reference to race on the surface of that law. But it takes just one glance at the real facts to know this is probably intended to be a racially conscious approach to admissions because we know just how deeply segregated Texas schools are by race. Not necessarily by law, maybe it's a legacy of many past actions, but we know that if we pick 10% from every high school and say you are automatically admitted, that in itself will guarantee some measure of representation in the entering class at UT. Then it's the second level of this, and this is the layer at which race is taken into account for filling in the last 20% of the seats in the class. So the argument from the point of view of the university has got to be we're engaging in a facially neutral approach to guarantee geographic distribution of access to University of Texas across the entire state. Now, if we have one plaintiff who was disappointed at not being admitted to the University of Texas, and her argument is straightforwardly, race is a suspect classification. We waged a civil war over slavery. We were supposed to put race behind us. And one of the standard doctrines in contemporary constitutional law is that government resort to classifying people on the basis of race or ethnicity is instantly suspect. What this plaintiff is saying is, with respect to my admission to this university, no, it's still suspect. I think it's wrong. That's going to be her argument.
Dean Johnson, we didn't mean to leave you out.
I just wanted
to get a final thought from you about what direction you think this case is taking and what you think it means. result?
Well, I think the case is a complicated one, that affirmative action is a very difficult societal issue, and that we're still trying to work out, like we're trying to work out many issues of race in American society. I do think it's important to keep in mind that I think that the University of Texas was acting in good faith, trying to follow the Supreme Court's decision in Grutter. And it's also important to note that the 10% rule, as it's called in Texas, allows the top 10% from every high school in the state to be eligible for admission to the University of Texas. That means that Abigail Fisher wasn't in the top 10% of her high school and didn't get admitted through that process. So the part that she's complaining about is the 20% the admissions process, where many factors are considered, whether it's athletics, musical ability, race is one factor, and it was a multi-factor, not race is the dispositive factor here. And I think the Supreme Court, in important respects, had it right in the Grutter decision in saying, at some level, we should defer to the university in considering race in its admissions process and considering things like the importance of having a critical mass of minorities in the student body and in the classroom. It benefits the education of all students to have a diverse student body.
That was Kevin Johnson. He's Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. He joined us from the campus of the University of California Davis. Jim Chen is Dean and Professor of Law at the Brandeis School of Law at the University of Louisville. He's also a former clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and he joined us from member station WFPL in Louisville. Dean Chen, Dean Johnson, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Students look alert and engaged in Sandra Castillo's third grade class at the Primitivo Garcia Elementary School in Kansas City, Missouri.
We had to put all the pills away.
But the entire public school system in Kansas City has flunked. The State Board of Education revoked its accreditation on January 1st. The Kansas City Public Schools met just 3 of the 14 standards set by the Missouri Board of Education for basic proficiency. They got failing grades for attendance, graduation rates, math, and reading and writing scores. Last week, we reported on the decades of mismanagement, declining enrollment, and revolving door superintendents. Now, there's a struggle for the future of the schools that may be a battle for Kansas City itself. Sly James, the new mayor, says,
I can't think of anything that I'm supposed to do as the mayor of this city that is in some way affected by or built on education. Nothing.
From lowering crime to creating jobs and making the city grow.
I can tell you that the perception of having things that are not functional does not help you attract people and keep them in the city. They go to where they can find success for their children.
Mayor James, the Sly is for Sylvester, is a large, solid man who speaks with short, blunt stabs of his hands. He says that he should take charge, as mayors have in New York, Chicago, Boston, and other cities. He believes that only a mayor can wrestle bureaucracies and rally private resources and public opinion to save schools.
It is a crisis, and it's one that we have to address if we're going to stay vital and if we're going to repopulate this city and stabilize our tax base and grow.
The mayor would abolish the elected school board and create a corporate structure headed by a CEO, chief educational officer, that he would choose. James is a lawyer and new to politics. A lot of people in Kansas City laud his determination, but question the results of mayoral control in other cities. Some also see another option for reform that's right next door. A bill introduced in the Missouri State Senate would disband the Kansas City Public School District and force adjacent districts to absorb the city's public schools. We met Dr. Jim Hinson, the superintendent of the neighboring Independence, Missouri School District at Van Horn High School. Now, Van Horn was part of the Kansas City Public School District for over 50 years. It's now run by the Independence School District because 5 years ago, the people in Kansas City and Independence voted to turn over Van Horn and 6 other Kansas City public schools to the Independence District. Test scores and graduation rates improved. 70% of the students at Van Horn come from families below the poverty line. The school offers counseling, meals, even dental service. Dr. Hinson says he saw Kansas City lose accreditation this year and asked,
if I have students that literally live across the street that are not in our school district, but I know historically the lack of success, do we have an obligation to try to be a part of a solution? And the answer for us is yes.
But critics say the apparent success Independence has had with a few schools shouldn't be a plan for all of Kansas City.
We're not saying everything is roses in the district. I don't think that parceling our schools out to suburban districts is a way to solve the problem.
Crystal Williams is a county legislator and a parent with a son in the Kansas City Public Schools. She's a small woman with short brown hair and a direct, challenging manner who describes herself as part of a crew of concerned parents who log long hours in community and committee meetings. They call themselves the Do-Gooder Mafia. She believes Kansas City should be left to work out its own solution to its school crisis.
The city is ready and willing to go forward and come up with the solutions we need.
But cities had 20 years. Why should anybody give them even another 20 months?
Because we have more engagement in this community than we've had since we've lived here. I think maybe there's more engagement than there's ever been. Sometimes when you're threatened with loss, you finally get your crap together and you move forward and do what you need to do.
But the number of families with children in the public schools has dramatically declined. Enrollment reached 77,000 in the late 1960s. It's just under 16,000 today. Stephen Green became Kansas City's interim school superintendent suddenly this summer after the previous superintendent unexpectedly resigned. Dr. Green has thick glasses, a trim beard, and speaks in calm, unhurried sentences. We asked him if the numbers in Kansas City have dwindled so seriously because most Kansas City parents just don't feel that their schools are good enough or safe enough for their children.
Yep, and I think they have good reason. I think we have not performed well. It's our responsibility to reverse that trend, to change that, particularly to change it in 180 degree is going to be an uphill climb.
When you say things like, we've got to change it 180 degrees, and it's a slow process.
Over time.
To a parent, that's not a good argument for them to entrust their children to you right now.
Well, I'd love to be able to say that I could snap my fingers and make it happen right away. But that's the reality. And I'm saying 3 to 5 years of turnaround is going to take.
Any turnaround will have to meet modern educational metrics, the hard numbers that translate to achievement. Dr. Green laid out the math problem that he has to solve.
If 5 or 6 students per grade level per building were to make movement from below basic to basic or basic to proficient, we will meet these academic achievement targets.
Dr. Green says the district has already met 2 more of the 14 standards to win back accreditation. So far, none of those standards has been academic, and there are 9 more measures. And schools have responsibilities these days that may not be tied to accreditation, but are vital. Like this. By their own numbers, roughly 9% of Kansas City public school students are homeless.
I need to give you one coat, but there's you have a coat.
This is like the 3rd allotment of coats that they've gotten.
So this year, the district opened a shop in which parents who can't afford them can pick up school supplies and uniforms for their children, even socks and underwear.
I don't know, how many people do you think we served that day?
1,500 that day.
1,500 people.
That's where we found Fred Hudgens, who's had 3 children in the public schools. He's a heavy, smiling man who wears a union coat and hat. He's a crane operator, but between jobs now, and volunteers his time at the shop. He believes that Kansas City's failing grade could be a kind of wrecking ball to help the schools build something better.
You have civic leaders, you have politicians. The mayor even came in and gave a plan, which has never happened that I'm aware of over 40 years. And I think we start to look at how do we fix our city, because truly, this is a citywide problem. It's not just in the school district. And I think that this thing is going to come off. It's got to come off, or I mean, you know, there's no other option right now.
Kansas City Public Schools have 2 years to try to gain back the state's accreditation. That's time they may not get. The bill working through the state Senate would dissolve the school district this summer, so the schools operate and uncertainty each day, which poses a question for any parent who sends a child into those classrooms. Do you want your child to stay in the Kansas City public schools while the adults work out their problems?
The drawdowns in Iraq and Afghanistan have brought many service members back to their families and to the civilian job market. While a new law offers incentives to employers who hire them, many veterans are also trying to start their own businesses. And a rigorous free program started at Syracuse University is giving them the tools to make it happen. That story now from Lucy Nalpathanchil of member station WNPR.
25-year-old Edward Young spends a lot of time in his Ford truck. It's an F-350 dually that tows an enclosed two-car trailer. Young lives in Connecticut and runs an auto transport business that takes him all over the country to pick up and drop off vehicles. This delivery in a suburb outside Hartford is a jaw-dropper. He's unloading a 1989 black Rolls-Royce.
It's a boat, really. It's probably about a good 19 feet long. Black and leather. I think it's even got heated seats. You know, it's a beautiful car. It's practically brand new.
Just 4 years ago, Young was in Iraq, driving convoys as a Navy Seabee. After a year deployment, he came home and struggled with finding work and drinking too much. He had trouble connecting with his family and became suicidal. Young ended up getting counseling for PTSD at the local VA hospital. He says the long-distance drives help him cope.
You know, this is easier just to get away. You know, it seems like I'm avoiding life home, but, you know, being on the road, it's like being deployed. You know, it's kind of the same thing. Keep him busy.
After leaving the service, Young thought about running his own business. After attending a veterans forum at a local community college last year, he learned about the entrepreneurship boot camp for veterans with disabilities at the University of Connecticut. Mike Haney, a former Air Force officer and professor of entrepreneurship at Syracuse, came up with the idea known as EBV in 2007. Today, Syracuse, UConn, and six other business schools run the free training program that helps veterans learn everything from business and marketing plans to creating their own websites and logos, all free of charge. Haney says veterans are drawn to the intensity of the two-month program and recalls the story of one particular EBV grad.
He said, as a Marine infantry officer, I learned how to make sense of chaos, and I learned how to make decisions in the face of chaos. And really, that's what entrepreneurship is all about.
Since 2008, more than 400 veterans have completed EBV. Nearly 70% of them have launched a business. Haney says a large alumni network is one of the keys to their success.
I have a very, very, very long list of successful alumni in a broad spectrum of industries who have come to us and said, listen, if you have a vet who is interested in starting a business in real estate or in media or whatever it is, let me help them. Let me mentor them.
Marine Brian Iglesias is an EBV grad who launched his own film company in 2009.
My mentor was a VP of distribution for Fox Searchlight. You couldn't get any better than that.
Haney says the wait list for EBV keeps growing. Last year, there was room for only 35% of the nearly 500 who applied. Even with EBV's training and connections, Ed Young still struggled to get his business started. He applied to 10 different banks before finding one that would give him a loan, and he's just starting to make money. Despite the challenges, Young says he's happy being his own boss, and now he's going to work on his personal relationships.
I have problems connecting with people all the time, especially, you know, family members. It just feels like I missed a lot in everyone's life, and it's like trying to play catch-up.
Young's plan is to keep driving so he can make enough money to expand. He says he'd like to hire a fellow veteran because the camaraderie of military life doesn't end once the service is over. For NPR News, I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil in Hartford.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Transcripts for the stories you hear today are available for free tomorrow when you visit the story page on NPR.org. Listeners like you make this and other programs possible. Thanks for supporting public radio. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Los Angeles has decided to help kids get to class instead of fining them when they don't make it. The city has long had a tough stance on truancy, for a decade slapping huge fines on students for skipping school or even being late. But LA City Council is now changing that law because it turns out the fines were backfiring. Chrissy Clark from member station KQED reports.
2 years ago, Nabil Romero, a young Angelino with a thin black mustache, was running late to his first period class at a public high school on LA's west side.
I lived two bus rides away from my school. The first bus ride took 45 minutes, the second one did as well. By the time I arrived school, I was approached by police officers and I was told to stop. I was handcuffed, searched.
Romero had to pay a $350 truancy fine. In a single-parent home like his, that was a lot.
When my mom heard the fine, she was like, oh, we're going to have to cut back on a lot of stuff. And we started cutting back on food expenses, on clothes expenses, shoes, and this was all my fault.
Well, maybe not all his fault. The ticket Romero got was for breaking the city of LA's daytime curfew law, a law that critics say often punishes low-income kids making an honest effort to get to school. Manuel Criollo is an organizer with LA's Community Rights Campaign. He says when he first started hearing stories like Romero's a few years ago, stories about police ticketing kids on their way to campus or rounding them up at bus stops.
To be honest, all of us were like, okay, are you guys literally saying they're at the bus stop? And we went out there and you had police or school police basically waiting for young people to give them tickets.
Criollo's group got a hold of police data showing that in 5 years, officers issued 47,000 truancy tickets, most right next to schools in lower-income neighborhoods. Blacks and Latinos received a disproportionate number of the tickets compared to the makeup of the student population. The daytime curfew only applies to unaccompanied minors, and Criollo points out that in richer neighborhoods, tardy kids often escape tickets because their parents drive them to school. But kids in poor neighborhoods, they usually rely on public buses.
We want justice for our students. One, we are the people. Two, a little bit louder. Three.
At a recent rally, teacher Andrew Terranova explains that tickets meant to scare kids into going to school have had the opposite effect.
I had students who I would say, "What? Where were you yesterday? You were absent from my class, right? Oh, mister, I was late. I missed my connecting bus, so I went home. Why'd you go home? Well, I was afraid of getting another truancy ticket."
The fines were really crazy.
And that's coming from the guy who issues them, Michael Nash, the presiding judge for LA's juvenile court, where most of the tickets and fines are handled and can quickly add up to thousands of dollars.
And we really weren't accomplishing anything.
The court's not going to solve that problem if kids are late to school. That's something for the schools to work out with the kids and the families.
So now, under the new daytime curfew law, police must avoid targeting students clearly headed to campus in the first 90 minutes of school. Steve Zipperman is the LA school police chief.
We have to take a look at what can we do to try and help us resolve the root problem of this rather than the Band-Aid approach of just writing the citation.
When tickets are issued, fines will be waived for the first two offenses, and students will have to work with counselors to come up with an attendance plan, looking into transportation issues or family stuff that might be getting in the way. City Councilman Tony Cardenas recently summed up the city's new approach to a crowd of students inside City Hall.
Young people, this is not a permission slip to be late. There are still our consequences. However, instead of purely punishing like the current system, we will be there for you. We will be there with you.
Believe it or not, Cardenas told them, an adult is actually going to talk to you and help you figure out how to get to school on time. For NPR News, I'm Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles.
And also reporting on that story, Susan Ferris of the Center for Public Integrity.